everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very pleased to have Toby Lester on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific new book, The Fourth Part of the World, The Race to the End of the Earth, and the Epic Story of the Map That Gave America Its Name. We think of the world as round and having a lot of different parts. People in the Middle Ages and in early modern Europe thought of the earth as round, no, not flat, and having three parts. They were Europe, Asia, and Africa. In this fascinating book, Toby Lester tells the story of how the fourth part of the world, that is the part that yours truly is sitting on right now, North and South America, came to be discovered. At its center is a kind of paradox that Europeans didn't see the Pacific Ocean, or I think know the Pacific Ocean existed until 1513, but somehow the Pacific Ocean, not under that name, of course, appeared in a map in 1507, the so-called Waldseemüller map. Toby does a great job of untangling this particular historical problem, and a lot of others to boot. I really enjoyed talking to Toby today, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Toby.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm doing well.
Oh, you're in Boston, is that correct?
I am. A clear, snowy day.
Clear, snowy day. We had a blizzard here last night. So,
congratulations.
Yeah, actually, it was very nice. I really like the snow. It's one of the reasons I've said many times on this show, I lived in California for a while, and I left because I didn't like the weather.
They don't
have snow there.
I'm the same way. I feel that way about Boston, too.
Yeah, no, I really like the weather. I should tell our listeners that we have Toby Lester on the show today, and it's my great, great pleasure to talk to him again because we used to work together after a fashion a number of years ago. And he's written a terrific new book called The Fourth Part of the World, The Race to the Ends of the Earth, and the Epic Story of the Map That Gave America Its Name. It's just come out. I've read it cover to cover, and I have to tell you, it's a terrific read. For those of you that like very well-written literary history, I guess literary in the sense that it is written with a writerly instinct, I think you'll really enjoy this book, and I encourage you to go buy it. One of the terrific things about the book, I should say just as a kind of sidebar, is that it covers a lot of ground, and I really like that in a book. You know, I like a narrow book occasionally, but this book really covers a lot of late medieval and early modern Europe and discoveries in America and Asia and Africa and you name it, and it's in there. Obviously, there's a significant amount of erudition behind this book, and Toby did a lot of research, a lot of really terrific research, and the topic is well chosen. It's really kind of a model for the kind of book that should receive a wide readership. So with that encomium, let me ask you, Toby, to just tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from and how you became interested in writing and this sort of thing.
Sure. Well, I had no idea when I was younger that I ended up doing this. I grew up in New England, roughly speaking, and I went to college at the University of Virginia and studied English and French, subjects that are the kinds of things people study when they don't know what else they want to do. I went off into the Peace Corps and served in Yemen for a couple of years as an English teacher. And then I ended up working for the Peace Corps, helping set up programs in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, and then for a couple of years also worked for the United Nations in the West Bank. But at a point decided that I wasn't really working my mind as much as I wanted to, and got the idea that it'd be interesting to learn how the writing business works. And so I volunteered myself as an intern at The Atlantic, which was a magazine I'd read for years. And probably they agreed to have me come. And as it happened, somebody went on leave while I was there, and I filled in for her. And then the internet took off, and I helped create the magazine's website. And over time, I got into editing and writing and ended up staying at the magazine for about a decade. All of which made me more and more interested in writing and more aware of how little I knew when it came to, for example, history. And then in 2005, when the magazine was moved from Boston to Washington, that seemed like a natural point for me to try something new. My wife and I decided we didn't want to move to D.C., and I landed on this subject for a book.
Had you been interested at all in, I guess, again, being an academic, I want to call it the history of cartography, but there's so much more in this book. Had you been interested in late medieval and early modern history before? How did you happen upon this particular topic?
Okay, well, I'll tell you how I happened on it first, and then I'll tell you. The short answer to the question is no, I hadn't really had an interest in this before, and I had studied embarrassingly little history throughout my education. So in a way, ever since, I've been trying to rectify that just in a sort of self-edification program. What happened in terms of this book and how I got the idea was that in 2003, while I was at the Atlantic, I got a press release from the Library of Congress announcing that for the kind of staggering sum of $10 million, the library had acquired what it called America's birth certificate, literally the map that had given America its name. And that sum itself got my attention. It was the most the library had ever spent on anything, and that's saying something. It was also about $2 million more than had recently been paid at auction for an original copy of the Declaration of Independence. So I'd never heard of the map. I'd never seen the map, and yet here were all these institutions and market forces saying it was one of the world's great treasures. So I wanted to learn a little bit more about it, and initially I thought I'd do an Atlantic article, but as I got into it, I realized just how much more there was to this map than just its naming of America, which is of course what most people, if they know about the map, kind of limit it to. But the very nature of this map, and particularly what its makers had in mind in the sort of grandest, most comprehensive way of thinking about it, is something that I got captivated by and tried in the end to sort of mirror in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think many people know about the Copernican Revolution and can say a little bit about that reoriented our solar system. But I don't think many people really know how a map like the Waldseemüller map, this is the one in question, really changed the way that people viewed the entire world. It's hard for us to wrap our minds around an image of the Earth that hasn't probably been gotten by that globe that was in everybody's grade school classroom. I don't know if you had that globe, but I think everybody had that globe, that tilted one, you know?
Yep.
Why was that always tilted? I always wondered about that. I don't know. But anyway, that globe. But these people, that is the people of the late Middle Ages, didn't see the Earth like that at all. It was really more like we see the stars today. We don't really know what's out there exactly. Tell us what they thought or saw or drew in, let's say, the 13th century when they thought about the Earth.
Well, this is one of the areas of this book that just so captivated me. If you go back far enough, and meaning back into the Middle Ages, you arrive at a point in human history where there wasn't just this single idea of what the world looked like. You know, today somebody tells you the phrase world map, and immediately you know what they're talking about, and you can conjure up this image of the oceans and the continents, and we're all on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
In the Middle Ages and in the centuries prior to the making of the Waldseemüller map in the beginning of the 16th century, there was that phrase could mean all sorts of different things, and depending who you were, you could imagine the world in profoundly different ways. You had a tradition of sort of academic/theological world mapping, which in some ways rooted itself in antiquity, and that basically announced that the world had three, at least the known world had three parts, Europe, Asia, and Africa. Since ancient times, it seems that the general way of depicting that was to put east at the top, not north. And this is another simple fact that people tend to overlook when they think about maps today, is that north isn't the natural top of a map. It's an arbitrary decision. And primarily in the Middle Ages, especially in Christian Europe, you see east at the top, but you do also see every direction at the top.
Yeah, it's funny. If I could just interrupt for a second. It's funny you mentioned this. I have young children at home, and I know you have three daughters. Is that right?
That's right.
There was a moment in which I noticed that they were learning how to turn the pages of books from left to right, which is completely arbitrary.
Right.
And that they were taking something which was completely arbitrary. You might as well – you can just as easily, and people in Japan do, turn them from right to left. But to them, this is completely natural, and they will grow up thinking that pages go from left to right and – or I mean right to left and – and globes have north at the top. That's somehow the way the world. That's somehow the way the world works.
And on a related note, I've found myself correcting all three of my daughters as they've started to draw people. You know, those kind of figures where it's a circle with arms coming out of the head. And but all three of them, at a certain point, I've noticed them drawing them what I would call upside down. they're looking at it, but the face is upside down. And from their perspective, it doesn't make any difference. And there's no reason you can't see it that way. And that kind of applies to the mapping of the world. There's a convention that has now settled firmly in place, but that just didn't exist in the Middle Ages, except that you do often find east at the top. And when you find there are a lot of good reasons for that. Particularly, again, in this kind of Judeo-Christian Muslim context, the sacred texts talk about the Garden of Eden and God planting Adam and Eve in the east. Just as a fact of life, the sun rises in the east, and so that's where time and history seem to begin. And then, at least in terms of history, the way that Europeans told it, you have the sort of the rise of the ancient civilizations in the east, and then history kind of gradually marches westward and reaches the Greeks and the Romans, and then there's this kind of corrective force that goes on in Jerusalem, and then again from the Western European perspective, Christianity moves into Europe, and eventually, at about the time I start my book, Christianity has bumped up against the Atlantic Ocean in Western Europe, and that's why I started the book there, because after that point, as Christianity solidifies and becomes more and more globally minded, you get Europeans starting to explore the East again.
If I could just stop you for a second, there's one thing that I thought was fascinating, and I can't believe it never occurred to me. You talk a little bit about the etymologies and broader meanings of the words Occidental and Oriental. Maybe you should say a few words about that, because it really is fascinating.
In Latin, the word Orient is derived from the word meaning to rise, and Occident is derived from the word meaning to fall. And that of course refers to the rise and fall of the sun, but it also in the Christian context sort of refers to the rising and dying of Christ on earth. But the phrase that survives today of orienting yourself, of course, means you're trying to figure out where east is, and that's what you see codified on these medieval maps is east at the top. Once you figure out where east is and you put it at the top and make it central, then you can orient yourself.
Yeah, this is that really made I had one of those moments where, as they say, the scales fell away from my eyes when I read that really wonderful passage about that. To orient yourself means to find the east, and that is a really sort of late medieval view of things, to find the east. So, and then Jerusalem is at the center of these maps?
Well, in the very strictly Christian late medieval sort of symbolic world maps, yes, and it almost looks like if you imagine a sort of exactly circular map with Asia sort of occupying the top semicircle and then Europe and Africa underneath, there's a kind of almost bullseye at the dead center, which is a kind of target for spiritual contemplation, but it's also symbolizing that this is really where there's the kind of almost umbilical connection to God. And in fact, a lot of medieval theologians used the Greek term omphalos for that point on the earth, and that actually literally means the navel.
Navel of the world, yeah.
And then you see, in fact, on some of these maps, the body of Christ superimposed on the earth, or the earth superimposed on the body of Christ, and of course the navel basically corresponds to Jerusalem.
Now, you mentioned a couple of people who I actually have done some research on myself in a very distant relation, who did travel to the east in search of something, or at least maybe they did. We don't really know. One of them is famous and one of them is not. The famous one is Marco Polo. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about him. And again, the thing that I was most interested in your book is how little we actually know about him.
Yeah, well, and with that preface, I'll qualify everything that I go on to say, because it's hard to know who he was, or even what that is said in his name is really by him. As the story goes, he he came back from his travels, which we can talk about more in a minute, but he ended up in jail in Italy, and one of his jailmates, and he started talking, and his jailmate, who was a composer of romance-type literature, ended up writing his book with the input that Marco Polo gave him. And so it's the book, it may be Marco Polo's words filtered through a very particular kind of person and writing style that isn't his own, and it may be considerably embellished, or it may be largely what in fact he said, and then that leads you into the question of whether what he said is actually what he did.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to believe that he did a lot of what he said, if not all of it. There is a school of thought out there that, you know, maybe he never even made it to China and made a lot of it up. But from what I can tell and from what I've read in the scholarship, it seems that the consensus is that much of what he describes in his book actually probably did take place. And the basic story is that he and his father and uncle set out in the late second half of the 13th century and made their way trying to find the Mongols, who at that point were a very powerful force making their way gradually toward dominion of pretty much all of Eurasia.
Mm-hmm.
And they were merchants, and they knew that the Mongols, in all of their expansion and raping and pillaging, were gathering huge hoards of wealth and were interested in spending money on luxuries. So what better place for an Italian merchant to go sell stuff? And somehow or another, they managed to find them and managed to make their way all the way to China, and the seat of the Mongol Empire in China. And Marco himself ended up somehow managing to ingratiate himself with the Mongol ruler, who we tend to call Kublai Khan now. And he seems to have, at that point, he was a young man and seems to have been a quick learner and mastered languages, and ended up being sent out on missions by the Khan to learn about the countries around China, you know, China itself, but then also a lot of the lands around there. He stayed for something like 17 years and then eventually made his way home. And here's what, to me, was fascinating. We tend to, when we think of Marco Polo, think of his long, arduous, and fascinating overland journey to China. And then you get like a sentence, and then he came back. But in fact, what he did was he came back not by land, which is the way he'd gone out, but by sea. And his descriptions of the regions that he passed through as he sailed through the Indian Ocean on his way back were hugely influential to later readers of his book in the Middle Ages. A lot of his descriptions of these fabulous islands that he visited, which he said were rich in gold and spices and gems, but also inhabited by cannibals and strange beings, that stuff percolated through a lot of the travel literature of the late Middle Ages and really became part of the mental furniture of people like Columbus as they imagined sailing back to the Far East and basically trying to find what it was that Marco Polo had described in the first place.
Mm-hmm. What route did he take back if he came back by sea?
Well, he came down. If you imagine, he was up in China. Uh-huh. So he sailed down along the east coast of China all the way down and then through the region that I guess we would call Indonesia now,
yeah.
Malaysia, made his way into the Indian Ocean. He talks about Java Major and Java Minor.
Uh-huh.
So some of what are often called the Spice Islands, and then back through the Indian Ocean, probably skimming along the coastline, stopping in at India. There's kind of convoluted talk of his being up in places that people think are Thailand and Burma, but it's very hard to make a kind of one-to-one correspondence with
mm-hmm.
it. It's a sort of phantasmagoric kind of muddle.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually he makes it back and makes his way up through, I guess what you would call Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
He lands in Persia, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And then makes his way back overland through what's initially Mongol territory there, ultimately back to Italy.
So then the second character, the one that is little known of, and the one actually I know a little bit more about, but not very much, is John de Pleno Carpini.
Right. One of my favorites.
Yeah. Why don't you talk a little bit about him?
Sure. He was a Franciscan monk, again in the 13th century, but he precedes Marco Polo. And he originally was one of the companions of St. Francis, so in on the ground. So the background to this story is that in the early decades of the 1200s, the Mongols, from the European perspective, just sort of swept in out of nowhere and managed to totally overwhelm everybody they came into contact with. They were mobile, they were organized, they had horses and tactics, military tactics that completely outclassed Europeans, and Europeans just sort of fell. City after city, province after province, and there seemed to be no stopping them. Europeans began to wonder whether these were sort of biblical, monstrous kinds of races of people who were being unleashed on the world to begin the end times. And if not that, then there was somebody who had to be contended with, not just on a military level, because that didn't seem to be working, but on a sort of religious and diplomatic level. And the Pope at the time convened a council, and one of the top items on the agenda was how to deal with the Mongols. And one of the ways that they decided they would deal with them was to send out some missionaries to try to find them and try to talk to them, try to learn about them, and ultimately to try to convince them to stop. And so Friar John was one of these initial emissaries, and managed to – and you have to imagine him as a kind of – almost as a Friar Tuck character. He was not a young man, and by accounts that survive, he was either portly or worse. Not the kind of guy you would want to send out on a grueling mission – that would take you up into parts of what we would call Russia now in the winter, and then that would take you across the steppe and into Central Asia on horseback in the company of just a few others and a Mongol escort. What he managed to do in the end was to cross thousands of miles of Eastern Europe, Russia, and then enter Central Asia and arrive at the headquarters of the Mongols up in what was called Karakorum in the Central Asian steppe, a journey that was thousands of miles that really hadn't been made except in the reverse direction by Mongols who could sweep through on their horses and were accustomed to living on the land. Living on the land literally meaning by often destroying the peoples who were there and just sucking the life out of their villages. So Friar John does this and arrives at the Mongol areas and then comes back with all sorts of reports of what he'd found there and gives that information to Europeans, and it's sobering information. It's not really what people had expected to hear. He had gone with letters from the Pope. He had hoped to present them to the Mongol Khan and have the Mongol Khan see the wrongness of his ways and almost submit to the authority of the Pope. And the Mongols the Khans had this way of sending back these dismissive demands of their own for submission. They make wonderful reading. My favorite is when one of the Mongol Khans writes to, I can't remember who right now, but it's one of the European leaders, and he says it would be better for you and healthier if you would submit to me. This is in the context of thousands of Europeans being slaughtered. So anyway, he comes back with lots of this information, and he goes on a little bit of a book tour. He's talking to people all over about it, and then his writings about the subject get anthologized in some 13th century encyclopedia kinds of works, and what he had to say about the Mongols was one of the prime sources for Europeans in the decades and centuries that followed, leading right up to the time of Columbus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A lot of what he reported about Central Asia and the Mongols fixed itself in people's minds even after the Mongol Empire had dissolved and the Mongols really weren't in place in the way that they had been. But mm-hmm. that itself was an interesting situation because mm-hmm. Columbus, to cite just one example, had this idea that if he could reach the Far East, he could find the kinds of Mongol seats of power that Friar John had talked about, but also that Marco Polo had talked about. Mm-hmm. And Marco Polo, when he was describing Kublai Khan, had described a very civilized ruler and a country of great, great wealth that happened to have lots of Christians in it.
Mm-hmm.
These are Eastern sects of Christianity that had spread in the Middle Ages, that by the time the 15th century rolled around had faded.
Mm-hmm.
But Columbus and others didn't know that, so they mm-hmm. they'd be able to not only tap into the riches of the Far East, but in a way kind of rejoin Western Christianity with Eastern Christianity, and that has a kind of crusading context.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Has this to do with the myth of Prester John?
Oh, absolutely. Prester John is a mythical Christian king who was said in the 11 and 1200s to dwell out there in the Far East somewhere, and who had amassed great wealth and great armies, and who also was said to be imminently on his way to Jerusalem to help Western Christians reconquer mm-hmm. it. So there's this idea of a kind of pincer move that would reclaim the Holy Land from the Muslims. And that idea, that crusading ideal, was actually one that was very much in Columbus's head. People don't tend to talk about that, but he makes references in his own writings and in his letters to the King and Queen of Spain that he's mm-hmm. He's going to the Far East because he's going to get a lot of money, and then he can use that money to help them reconquer Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I would encourage anybody to actually read some of the words that Columbus wrote about his own journeys and the letters to Ferdinand and Isabella, because they are filled with crusading imagery. I mean, he was going to spread and reunite Catholicism. That was one of his primary aims. He did also talk a lot about gold, and that's what we tend to remember, but he was very excited about the idea that he was going to bring Christianity to the natives wherever he found them. So that's an important thing to remember. And when we talk about, I think, early modern imperialism of various sorts, it was largely religiously inspired. At least I would say that it was. Just as a side note, one of the cities that the Mongols destroyed, Rizan, actually was on an archaeological dig there, and they really did destroy it. After they destroyed it, they moved the town. They just moved it. It was completely razed. And actually, you can still see the walls of the city. They are earthen.
Yep.
And it was quite a large city, and the Mongols asked for submission, and the people of Rizan, I believe, refused. And so then the Mongols completely destroyed it. And if I'm remembering correctly, I think Carpini may have gone through Rizan, which is in southern Russia on the steppe now. It was the southernmost outpost of a branch of the Kievan monarchy. But I've borne witness to the destruction of the Mongols in the 13th century myself. Let's go on then. So Columbus and Vespucci and the other what we now call explorers had all of this in their head. That is that the earthly paradise was somehow in the East, that there were these fellows that had brought back news of either an earthly paradise in the case of Marco Polo, or something a little bit more sinister but nonetheless enticing in the case of Carpini. And then, of course, they decide to mount expeditions, really to go in search of these things. And one of the things I learned from your book is that the expeditions actually start quite small, in the sense that they're exploring the coast of Africa and the islands off in the Atlantic off Spain, which are called it's slipping my mind right now,
the Canary Islands.
Yes, exactly, the Canary Islands. And let me ask you this question. This may seem a little bit of a digression, but one of the most amazing things I read in your book is that when the the Spanish or Portuguese or Italians or whoever the sailors were who were sailing to the west in search of the east, so to say, got to the Canary Islands, that they were inhabited. Is that true?
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing. Who was on them?
Well, it's a race that's disappeared because they're all enslaved and destroyed, basically. But it seems like they were probably of Berber stock, you know, that they had made their way there from Morocco and the Western Sahara kind of region. They put up a good fight too. It seems like there are a number of islands in that chain. Some of them Europeans were able to subdue relatively quickly. Some of them weren't inhabited, and then there were other islands when these peoples, as is often the case, retreated up into the mountains and then kind of, you know, began a kind of guerrilla campaign of resistance, and it took a long time. Mm-hmm. But the dynamic that you see playing out there is really one that would then play out again in mm-hmm. the Americas when Europeans got there. Gradually, the Europeans established themselves in these places and began enslaving the population, even after initially making friendly contact.
Mm-hmm.
And then that leads to their demise.
Yeah, I just find that fascinating. I had no idea that islands like Tenerife is one of them, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah, that was inhabited. I just had no idea whatsoever. And those people disappeared completely and very quickly.
Well, and what I particularly liked about that whole episode is that it established in the minds of Europeans that there were these islands, and because they're inhabited and because they are where they are, off the coast of Northwest Africa, they began to look at ancient geographical texts and see that the Romans and the Greeks had described visits to islands like these that were inhabited, and you start to see something that would happen a lot in the late 1300s and 1400s, which is European scholars going very carefully through ancient geographical texts, trying to figure out correspondences with the places that modern sailors are now reaching again.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty quickly after these islands were first visited by Europeans in the Middle Ages that scholars make the identification of the Canaries with the Fortunate Islands, which is sort of mythical islands that are talked about. And the reason that they're called the Canaries is it has nothing to do with canaries. It's that the Romans gave them that name in part because of dogs.
Uh-huh.
And they're a lot of the names that they bore in the early period of European discovery are the ancient names.
Uh-huh.
You see this attempt to match up the ancient world with the modern world.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
and you never quite, when you look at maps of the time, in the early 1400s, maps and a geographical book written by the ancient Greek geographer Claudius Ptolemy were rediscovered in Europe, and that gave Europeans a really wonderful and fantastically detailed picture of the world as it had been known and imagined mm-hmm. in basically at the height of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you've got sailors bringing charts home of new coastlines, and there's this effort that goes on for a long time to try to reconcile those.
Mm-hmm.
And when Marco Polo wrote his book, he's describing regions of the world that appear on Ptolemy's map in part, and you get Italians in particular trying to reconstruct where he might have gone as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, this is one of the places where humanism, and I really like your definition of humanism, which actually cuts right to the quick, and that is it's about the reception of classical texts more than anything else, really misled them in various ways, because the Romans and the Greeks, whom they so much admired, for all of their various skill, were really not very good cartographers, as far as I can tell. And they had a tendency to make things up. So when attempting to match what they found in places like Ptolemy to what these workaday Portuguese sailors were finding on the coast of Africa and in the Canary Islands, they were often led astray pretty severely. I wanted to ask you this, though. One of the things they had to have recognized, or maybe they didn't, I don't know, when they got to the Canaries and found people, is that they weren't Asians. Or did they have a picture of what Asians were like?
Yeah, so, well, and but they also weren't black.
Yeah.
And I mean that was what struck them more about the Canaries, was because they were in the vicinity of Africa, and yet these people, they were a little hard to assimilate into the categories that Europeans had begun to develop. And this idea, there were theories out there that the closer you got to the equator, the darker your skin would be, and then related to that were sort of innate traits that made you more or less susceptible to certain ways of being. And of course, the Europeans were poised sort of halfway between the equator and the North Pole. Peoples to the north of the Europeans really weren't completely ideal, nor were people near the equator, because they were too prone either to sluggishness or to wiliness or something. So Europeans, being poisoned between them, had the right to rule over these other people.
Uh-huh.
And you could see in African people, that the darkness of their skin sort of made this manifest. But then when they got to the Canaries and saw lighter-skinned peoples, it was kind of flummoxing to them.
So how did they attempt to assimilate these people in the Canary Islands? What did they say about them? Did they say, "Oh, we've discovered Asia"? Or
there aren't a whole lot of records of what these encounters were like, but the main one that survives from the early encounters is one that seems to have originally been a letter from merchants, Italian merchants based in the Iberian Peninsula, who wrote back to Florence describing one of these voyages and describing some of the captives. But of course, when they arrived, they immediately took people captive and brought them back. And the way that they describe them comes through the mouth of Boccaccio, and Boccaccio leans on the fact that these people seem to be more nimble and more mentally agile than you would expect. That corresponds maybe with the fact that these are the Fortunate Isles of legend, which means that it's not so much part of Africa as something else, something more mythical. And these people are living in a state of, pre-lapsarian innocence.
Yes,
almost.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Before we proceed, we have to clear one thing up that constantly creeps into discussions, a little bit like a burr in your sock, about Columbus's voyages and Vespucci's voyages, and that is the notion that somehow somebody who knew what they were talking about thought the Earth was flat.
Right. Let's dispel that right now. There is a steady line of thought that progresses way back from ancient times all the way through the Middle Ages and up to Columbus's time that makes it clear that everybody, or just about everybody, knew that the world was round. And there are all sorts of empirical ways that you can know this, and people did know this, and you've got texts in the ancient world and in the early medieval world and the late medieval world that are called things like the sphere when they're describing the world.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a model of the universe that prevails throughout that time, which is entirely based on the sphere as the perfect shape, and it has the Earth as a sphere at the center of all creation, and it's surrounded by these various planetary and celestial spheres.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that somehow everybody thought the world was flat and because of that laughed at Columbus when he said he could sail around the world is a kind of ludicrous myth, apparently a myth that was propagated to a large degree by Washington Irving in the 19th century. He wrote a biography of Columbus and really played that up in a way that has had a powerful afterlife.
Yeah, this one won't die. It's too good. You know, it's like, in the magazine world, too good to fact check.
We just, right,
yeah, it's too rich. But it's just false.
What's fun about that though is in the Washington Irving version of the Columbus story, Columbus has this visionary idea, sees the truth about the world as round that he can, for the first time, prove to everybody, and he gets laughed out of the court in Portugal and Spain because everybody there is so ignorant that they think the world is flat. Well, in fact, what was happening was that the advisors to the courts were actually fairly sophisticated cosmographers, you would call them, and they had a reasonably good idea about not only the shape of the Earth but the size. And they could tell that what Columbus was proposing to do, namely sail from the west coast of Europe across the ocean to the east coast of China, really was impossible for a boat and a crew at that time in history. And if you were to just make the Americas disappear and imagine that someone was actually going to try to sail from, let's say, Spain all the way to China, it just wouldn't have happened.
It was a
supreme accident of history that Columbus happened to bump into the Americas, because at the time he did, his voyage was starting to not go so well.
Yeah.
The sailors were getting very, very worried. They'd been out of sight of land for something like 30 odd days, and everybody was getting quite mutinous because they were worried that the winds had been pushing them so far that way that they were never going to make their way back. Had the Americans not been there, they probably would have been mutiny and then death on the high seas, and the whole episode would have been forgotten.
Right. This is why these islands that we mentioned earlier are so important, because the Portuguese and the Spanish and Italians knew roughly how large the Earth was in terms of circumference, and they also knew that no ship could travel from Portugal to where they generally thought China started, that it was simply too far. It was like us going to Mars. We can't get out there.
Right.
So there had to be something. If they were going to make it, there had to be some way station, and that's why these islands, I guess, were so enticing to them, because they wanted to be the way station.
So they were discovering that these various islands chains, the Canaries, but then also other chains, including the Azores, which are pretty far out there.
Yeah.
They were successively finding these islands out there, and it almost seemed like they could island hop.
Yeah.
And in addition to these real islands that they began to establish a presence on, there were mythical islands that had been part of European and Islamic lore for a long time that seemed to lie out farther, but that if you were able to rediscover the mythical Fortunate Isles, which they identified with the Canaries, then there was every reason to believe that you could rediscover other mythical islands that were also out there. That kind of idea of the ocean as this kind of island hopping area was very powerful. And in fact, when word of Columbus's arrival in the New World first trickles back to Europe, remember at that point he'd only found islands in the Caribbean, not the mainland. Some of the earliest accounts of what he'd found say that Columbus seems to have found some new Canary Islands. There's really not a sense of what it is. And he's announcing to the world that he's found the Indies in the Far East.
Yeah.
Some skeptics who just can't believe that he could have sailed that far is saying he's just reached, the next logical step in some of these islands out there in the middle of the ocean.
I see.
And one other thing, if I can just
please
digress slightly, the Greeks actually were very good cartographers, given what information they were working with, and Ptolemy codified the system that we use today, latitude and longitude, and managed. Given the time he was working and the information he had available to him, to create a picture of the world that really was unparalleled. He assimilated a lot of the information that had come before him, and it was a very mathematical approach that accounted for the curvature of the Earth. So it's not really right to say that they were bad.
No, yeah, I didn't mean to say that at all. In fact, one of the examples that my wife sometimes gives in geometry classes is how the Greeks figured the curvature of the Earth, and from the curvature of the Earth figured the circumference of the Earth, and they did it with shadows and wells.
Right, exactly.
And that's not very much information.
No, but what Ptolemy did then, which is kind of staggering, is it was relatively easy for somebody to determine latitude, because if you look at the night sky and you see the pole star, the angle of the pole star tells you your latitude. So as long as you can see it, that's fairly easy. Longitude is a much harder task, and really the only way that Ptolemy could do it was through actual measured distances. The Romans were surveyors, and particularly in Europe, they had pretty good sense of distances. But then Ptolemy had to work with people's accounts of sailing across the Indian Ocean from centuries before him. And that's an awfully inexact science, but he did what he could. One of the things that that meant, though, was that he overestimated the latitudinal extent of Eurasia.
Mm-hmm.
And his Eurasia, at least the part of it that he put on his map, covered a full 180 degrees. And mm-hmm. beyond that, so if you start the Canary Islands, the Fortunate Islands was where he put the zero point of longitude.
Yeah.
And then his map went all the way to somewhere out in China at 180 degrees. That already is a big stretching out of the landmass.
Yeah.
Then when Marco Polo came back with his stories, he was talking about a part of China that went all the way to the sea. So that extended the Far East considerably out beyond where Ptolemy had stopped.
Uh-huh.
And all of that led Europeans to believe that the Eurasian landmass wrapped around considerably more than just half of the globe,
mm-hmm.
All of which diminishes the size of the ocean that they imagined separated Europe from Asia,
mm-hmm.
which made it seem possible to somebody like Columbus, who was very opportunistic in trying to find estimates that made the land
uh-huh.
wide and the sea small,
uh-huh.
It made it seem to him like he actually could make that journey.
Yes, and the extent of Eurasia in these early maps will be important in just a second, because it will lead to the production of a kind of narrow, slivery sort of North and South America. Try to fit it in there. You know, it can only be so big given what they thought about the extent of Eurasia. But let's talk a little bit about Columbus just for a second. So he sails the ocean blue. He goes over there and he finds some islands, and he comes back. And what does he say about them?
Well, all along his intent and his belief had been that he could sail to the Indies. And by India was a very loose concept. It's sort of what we would call Asia or the East today. In fact, India was at the time divided into three parts. So the three Indias covered much of what we now know as India and China and the islands even mm-hmm. of the Indian Ocean. Columbus was fixated on the idea that he could sail across and reach Japan and the parts of China that the Mongols for a time in the 13th century and early 14th century had been ruling over.
Mm-hmm.
And when he arrives in the Caribbean, he bumps into what maps of his time showed the Far East to look like.
Mm-hmm.
An archipelago of islands, some of them really big and a lot of them small. He projects onto that island world, the island world that he sees on maps of his own time, which call those islands the Indies.
Mm-hmm.
So he writes back after his first trip and says, I found the Indies, and the implication is that, you know, if you send me back on a second voyage, I'm going to be able to establish a colony there, and soon I'll have found the Great Khan, and I'll have tapped into not only this world of unimaginable mineral richness, gold and gems and spices too, but I'll also have probably figured out a way to reunite with these Christians who are living out there who've so long been separated from us, and all of that in turn is going to help us
mm-hmm.
Control, you know, ultimately take dominion over the whole world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he goes, he relates this information and then comes back and is promptly sent back a couple of more times.
Right. The second trip that he makes, everybody got very excited, and the second trip he makes is the first one everybody knows about, four relatively small boats, and they sail across, and it's all improbable, that's become a kind of mythical journey. The second one was this giant colonial enterprise involving enough supplies to set up a really ambitious colony on what we now know as Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and bigger than anything that had ever been undertaken in the entire exploration of Africa and really in the entire history of early modern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But they come back and they start to set up this colony, but everything quickly unravels because, of course, they haven't found gold, and it actually turned out not to be that fun to be there if you're a European colonist, and the natives are increasingly figuring out that these guys aren't really there to be their friends, and things just don't go well. And Columbus, although he keeps trying, can't figure out where Japan and China are. And it's fascinating to read his letters because you see him groping all the time and working with geographical materials, with maps, with books like Marco Polo's book and the book, the travel book that was very, very popular at the same time called The Travels of John Mandeville.
Mm-hmm.
And he just can't make them correspond to what's actually there, try as he might. And so when he has to report back to Spain on what's going on, he's not really living up to his promise. And that, in turn, leads him into either a kind of religious delusion or a very canny political calculation.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever was going on, he starts to get talk about the discovery of the New World increasingly in terms of religion and the location of the earthly paradise, and his role really as an enabler of the march of Christianity around the world, and even as a kind of character who has been put on earth by God in order to help bring the end times about.
Mm-hmm.
In part because, if you remember what we were talking about with the medieval maps, there's this idea that not only the sun rose in the east and fell in the west, but also human history had this inevitable progression from its beginnings in the east, where the Garden of Eden was, to its end in the west. And Columbus, by making the circuit of the earth and bringing human history literally full circle back from where it started to, again, the location of the earth, the paradise, which he announced the sovereigns of Spain that he had located in what we would call Venezuela today, that he was hastening the end of the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there's some question about his sanity at the end. But in any event, does it ever dawn on him that he's found a continent?
There's a little bit of debate about that, but I think it's safe to say no. I mean, he right until the end, he's talking about these places as some still to be determined part of Asia, and he clearly is increasingly desperately trying to connect what he's finding in real life with what he can see on maps of the time as Asia. With some regularity, he talks about place names that are on Ptolemy's maps and says, you know, I think I found it. He's also using some of the names that you see for Japan and Mongol-occupied territories described by Marco Polo, and he keeps on, Japan in particular keeps moving. He thinks it's Haiti, he thinks it's Cuba. And then he also goes back into the Bible and studies biblical geography and starts identifying the island that he called Hispaniola, which is Haiti in the Dominican Republic, with some of the biblical islands that were supposed to have been the sources of gold that King Solomon was able to use to build the temple in Jerusalem, which, of course, is the basic idea that Columbus had in mind for himself. He was going to be sailing to rich, bringing back gold and helping rebuild Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It gets very fascinating and strange.
Yeah, no, I mean, one of the constant themes of this show is that what most people think they know, they don't really know. And I think that can be said about Columbus in spades, is that there's a lot of mythology about Columbus. And I'm reminded of something a professor of mine used to say, and it was about Ivan the Terrible. He said, the list of absolutely certain facts about Ivan the Terrible could all be put on one page. Mm-hmm. The rest of it, we're not really sure. So let's go on to Amerigo Vespucci, because he's very important to the Waldseemüller discovery of the fourth part of the world, or naming of the fourth part of the world. Why don't you tell us a little bit about him?
Sure. He was a merchant from Florence, and by all accounts not a particularly distinguished merchant, and he drifted over to the Iberian Peninsula in the late 1400s, as a lot of Italians did, because that's where a lot of the explorers of Africa and then the New World were setting out from and were bringing back wealth from. So it was a kind of sort of opportunistic move, but he was doing it. In fact, when he arrived, not long after he arrived, he helped outfit Columbus's second voyage, that big colonial enterprise. So he was initially not the guy who was grandly sailing across the seas, but it was the one responsible for making sure that Columbus's ships would have enough wine on them, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But evidently he got the bug, and he made a series of his own voyages across the Atlantic at the end of the 1400s and beginning of the 1500s. It's hard to know in what capacity he made those trips. It could be that he just tagged along as a kind of merchant scout. In the letters of his that survive, he, or whoever it is who's writing in his name, make him out to be a much more important presence, kind of directing the course of these explorations and almost single-handedly navigating through difficult waters and ensuring that these voyages actually succeed. At any rate, he basically followed in Columbus's wake, initially made his way to the northern part of South America, but then on one famous voyage, sailed thousands and thousands of miles south along the coast of the New World, which is something Columbus never did. He restricted himself to the Caribbean. And it's really that voyage south, when Vespucci wrote home about it, that made the biggest impression in Europe about these New World discoveries. And if you think about it, Columbus had announced that he'd found a new route across the ocean to an old familiar place in the Far East, which Europeans had known about for a long time. And since they knew the world was round, it made perfect sense that if you went west long enough, you'd get to the east. Vespucci, on the other hand, by sailing so far south and finding land, and inhabited land for that matter, thousands of miles below the below the equator, he literally sailed off maps of the time. He
mm-hmm.
was in a part of the world that hadn't been mapped, and that where most European geographers assumed that there wasn't and couldn't be land. So when he wrote back saying that he'd found this, it made him actually more of a celebrity discoverer than Columbus. But repeatedly in his letters, he talks about exploring an endless Asian land, and he, in the course of his explorations, is looking for a way to get around this strange new land and into the Indian Ocean. He still is looking at maps of the time and thinking he's on the verge of being in the Indian Ocean. So
mm-hmm.
It's often a case that people think Vespucci was the one who made this intellectual leap and identified these newly discovered shores as the New World.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case. The confusion comes because one of Vespucci's letters was it made its way into the hands of printers in Florence who published it under the title New World.
Mm-hmm.
And that letter became widely printed and reprinted around Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But that phrase New World is one that didn't mean at the time what we think it means. Europeans were describing a number of parts of the world that they had never visited before as a new world.
Mm-hmm.
The parts of southern Africa that the Portuguese were exploring, you see accounts describing those as a new world. Earlier accounts, some of the missionaries going out to the Far East described the East as a new world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's wrong to assume that Vespucci made this conceptual leap, and
mm-hmm.
that when he told Europe about it, everybody smacked their foreheads and fell down on the ground.
That's a nice image, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
If I'm not incorrect, one of these letters by Vespucci that was published, and there was a flourishing trade in publishing this sorts of things, the sort of travel literature, I've studied it myself, one of them makes it to Martin Waldseemüller, is that correct?
More than one, actually.
Okay.
But what happens is this New World letter, Mundus Novus in Latin, gets printed and reprinted a lot in like 1504, 1505. And one of the cities that it appears in is Strasbourg, right near the border with what's now Germany, but on the French side. And in Strasbourg is a young poet and scholar named Matthias Ringmann, who publishes his own version of it, and who then, not long after, starts working with Martin Waldseemüller, who is a map maker, in a little town outside of Strasbourg called Saint-Dié up in the Vosges Mountains. And the two of them had this idea that they were going to make a new atlas of Ptolemaic maps, but then they come across letters of Vespucci's, not just this new world letter, but another one as well. And they managed, through the help of the Duke of Lorraine, who sponsored their work, to see some of the very early sailors' charts of the New World. And for reasons that just aren't entirely clear, they are the ones who make this leap, and they decide that this isn't some still-to-be-determined part of Asia, but this actually is an entirely new part of the world, and because there have already been these traditional three parts, Europe, Asia, and Africa, they decide this must be a fourth part, and because they've read descriptions of it in Vespucci's letters, they decide to riff on his name and call it America. Mm-hmm. But they put, again, it's the southness of the New World that really makes the impression on them, and so they put the name America on what today we would call Brazil, which is, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of the coastline that Vespucci, in fact, was exploring and describing.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the peculiar thing, and it's one of the themes in your book, and it's actually a kind of it's kind of a setup for the entire intellectual adventure, and that is that, as far as we know, no European had seen the Pacific, at least no modern European, until Balboa does in 1513 or so. Is that right?
Right. So there's one reference in a late Columbus letter to some natives having talked about a large body of water on the other side of Central America, but it's not entirely clear how Columbus would have processed that information, mm-hmm. and even if he had, whether it would have made a difference in terms of what he believed. The standard story of the dawning European awareness of the New World is that Balboa climbs a mountain in Panama in 1513 and sees this vast ocean on the other side, and then 7 years or so later, Magellan sailed around the tip of South America and mm-hmm. across the Pacific, and that's the point at which Europeans realize that they're a long way from Asia. So the great mystery is then how and why Martin Waldseemüller and Matthias Ringmann in 1507 decided that this must be an entirely new continent. And they leave on the map. They depict it as surrounded by water, and then in the companion book that they wrote to accompany the map, they make it very, very clear that they don't have any doubt about this. They say this new fourth part of the world, which we call America, is completely surrounded by water. Mm-hmm. The language they use is not ambiguous. Mm-hmm. So the question becomes, how did they know?
Yeah, speculate a little bit for us. How did they know?
Well, this is one of the things that people talk about a lot when they talk about this map, and the ideas range from reasonable to ridiculous. On the spectrum of things, you can start with what to me is the most likely, which is that it's an educated guess. Remember that serious European cosmographers and geographers had a pretty good idea of the size of the Earth as a whole. They may not have had a good idea of the longitudinal extent of Eurasia, but even if they used Ptolemy's overestimate and added Marco Polo to it, the size of the ocean separating Europe and Spain was still far greater than the distances that Columbus and Vespucci and others seemed to have traveled. So if that's the case, and if these guys are finding something out there in the ocean that's not just another Canary Island, but in fact extends for thousands of miles south of the equator and seems to be endless, then this kind of has to be a new landmass. And there were in the geographical and cartographical tradition, there are speculations dating back to antiquity about the existence of some other continent out there. You know, Atlantis, of course, is one mm-hmm. one kind of idea that people are familiar with, but there are other traditions too, one of which held that there had to be a kind of counterbalance to the known world mm-hmm. On one side of the globe. So it wasn't improbable to think that just as sailors had rediscovered some of the islands that had been talked about in antiquity, that now out of the sea was emerging one of the great continents that had been talked about. And there's a prophecy by Virgil that actually is mentioned on the map that talks about how Caesar Augustus one day will actually extend his reach beyond beyond the reaches of the known world, across a great ocean, and to a new, great new land in the south, which, of course, corresponds exactly to what these guys are finding. So there's a sense that this is kind of prophecy fulfilled,
mm-hmm.
coupled with a kind of educated, almost mathematical understanding of the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I come down on the question. There's a theory out there which is plausible, that the Portuguese actually managed to sail around the southern tip of South America, possibly even Vespucci himself, in the early 1500s, or maybe even earlier, and that they kept this information secret, but they had charts of it, and somehow that information on those charts made it back to Martin Waldseemüller and was incorporated on this big map.
Mm-hmm.
That idea has all sorts of problems, I think, but there are plenty of people who believe that it's at least possible. And although I don't think that information would have remained secret for as long as it would have had to have influenced this map, and it's improbable that it would have made it just to these scholars working in Lorraine in the mountains than somebody else. I actually do think that the Portuguese probably knew more about South America than the conventional story of discovery has it. There was a lot of secrecy involved. They were in intense competition with Spain to stake out their territory. There are a lot of good reasons why they wouldn't have wanted to reveal that information.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the loopier side of things is the theory that's been peddled by Gavin Menzies in the book called 1421, which is that the Chinese in the early 1400s not only made very impressive voyages across the Indian Ocean to East Africa, which is rooted in fact, but in fact that they circumnavigated the entire globe and therefore knew not only about the coast of South America, but the west coast of all of the Americas, and had that information on their maps and then somehow conveyed that information either directly or indirectly to Europeans who had on their maps.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, although that book and that theory is wildly popular, I think I haven't seen a single serious scholar of this stuff give it any credit.
Well, many fanciful things are wildly popular, as you know, having worked in journalism. So one of the interesting things about this map is, and one of the things that I was really a little bit skeptical about, I don't understand it, is that 1,000 copies of it were printed. Is that right? 1,000?
Right. Well,
2,000? What was it?
1,000. That's
1,000,
right.
Yeah. And then all of them, not all, there only one complete copy survives.
Only one
complete copy.
Any copy, yeah.
So are there fragments of other copies that we know about, or
no? There's only one copy that survives, and it's the copy that was bought by the Library of Congress for $10 million, and that's on display there now. It survived because it was bound into a book that ended up just sitting dormant in libraries for hundreds of years. The number 1,000 comes from a later Waldseemüller map on which Waldseemüller makes this reference to an earlier map that he printed in 1,000 copies. That 1,000 copies might be an exact number, but it's also, you see references like that in the Middle Ages and the early Renaissance, just as a signifier for a lot.
Yeah.
So it may have been that they printed a lot, but the number shouldn't be taken too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not an improbable number given the other kinds of print runs that you see at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not one to be thrown away.
No, that's right. This is what bibliographers I think call ghosts, and actually people in medieval and early modern studies will know what that means. And these are items which we have reference to. We know that they existed, but we haven't found any extant copies of. And this one sounds like just the greatest ghost of all time.
It really was great. I mean, so what happened was this map is actually – it's a giant map. It's about 8 feet by 4.5 feet, and it consists of 12 separate sheets that each would have been printed on a separate wood block, and then you could assemble it to make a big map. And there are references from the time that talk about how you assemble these things. And the way you do it is you take a big linen sheet and you slather the back of your map with glue, and then you tack the map onto the sheet, and then you hang it up. All of which makes sense, but you come to think of preserving a map as about the worst thing you could do, especially in a time when maps are going to go, particularly maps of the New World, are going to go out of date very quickly.
Yeah.
So to me, the disappearance of 1,000 copies of this map actually is something very reasonable.
No, I mean, I guess you're right, because many people don't know this, but being from Kansas, I can tell you that glue is made from grain products often, and bugs like to eat grain products.
Yep.
And they will just eat it all up. No question about it. In fact,
well, and if you had these in rooms in Europe in the early Renaissance too, most of these places were full of soot from fireplaces, and there were vermin, and on and on and on. I mean, it's actually amazing that one survived, and the reason it survived was because it wasn't assembled that way. It was bound in a book, and a closed book turns out is one of the absolute best ways of preserving a document.
That's right. A closed book that is bound and not glued, I should say.
Right.
And these books were certainly bound in between boards.
Yeah.
So, and that is a heck of a good way to do it. Although you can still get wormholes in some of these things, but not, you know, glue will just absolutely be eaten up by bugs. There's no question about it. You let it sit out and you'll get larvae in it and they'll eat it. So you've convinced me. I think.
Well, when as far as the ghost story goes, what happened was that the map by the middle of the 16th century seems, it just disappears. No, you have catalogs of maps, and people have just forgotten about it. They know that who Martin Waldseemüller was, but they never mention his name in connection with this big map. But in the 19th century, especially when there was this resurgence of interest in the discovery of the New World, in part because of the build-up to the 400th anniversary, 1892, of Columbus's discovery, you get people combing through the archives, rediscovering the little book that accompanied the map, that talks about the map, and then people discovering copies of the map. And these dates are sort of, they know that the book was printed in 1507. They noticed that there's the first map that mentions America initially was thought to be in 1520, and then there are these copies that are unearthed that go back to the 1510s. And then even one a little bit earlier than that, and some of those copies are sketches that are made by university students or professors, and in some cases they talk about the map, you know, the original map that was made by the geographer from Saint-Dié. So it becomes, in the late 19th century, a kind of obsessive search for the holy grail of cartography to find this map, but people just can't do it. They look everywhere. And then, as is almost always the case, it happens by accident. In 1901, there's a Jesuit priest named Father Joseph Fisher, who was an expert on the cartography of the New World, goes to a minor castle in southern Germany to look into a different subject. And then after he's finished with that, he just combs through the holdings at the library and happens on this bound folio that nobody seems to know a whole lot about, opens it up, and realizes pretty quickly that he has found this almost mythical lost Waldseemüller map.
And he didn't have to take it to the Antique Roadshow to figure out what it was.
Nope.
He knew just exactly what he had.
Well, he had a mentor back in Germany who he then went to consult with, and the two of them published a book making these very grand claims about the map. And I think that's where the idea that it's America's birth certificate came from. I think they were the first to use that.
Right. Boy, would I like to be that guy. Isn't it just a fantastic story? I mean, imagine
coming
upon something.
Apparently he dined off that for years.
Yeah,
what's very, very interesting is that he's been fingered, I think pretty plausibly, as the author / forger of the Vinland map, which is the map that Yale University owns that purports to be a map of the New World that dates back, I think, to the 1440s, which was well before the Columbian discoveries, but which appears, by most accounts, to be a forgery.
Yeah, no, that's a good topic. That's a good topic too. Not to suggest anything. So anyway, we've taken up a huge amount of your time, and we've gone over time as I knew we would. And I should tell our listeners we've been talking to Toby Lester today about his terrific new book, The Fourth Part of the World. Toby, let me ask you our traditional final question here to close out the interview on New Books in History, and that is, what book are you working on now, or what is your next project?
Well, as it happens, this is week number one of working on my next one. I'm going to be doing another one for the same publisher, Free Press, and it's going to be something that grew tangentially out of this one. I don't know if you remember, but at a certain point in the first book, I talked a little bit about Leonardo da Vinci and his Vitruvian Man in the context of cartography, because that image has a kind of cartographical dimension that corresponds a lot to medieval maps of the world and maps of the microcosm, macrocosm. Mm-hmm. I got very interested in Vitruvian Man as I was doing this, but I realized I couldn't really shoehorn a whole lot of that into a book about the Waldseemüller map.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I'm going to try to do a sort of unpacking of the Vitruvian Man image in the same way that I tried to unpack the Waldseemüller map.
That's great.
There's a lot to it that people tend not to know about.
In fact, there's almost everything to it that I don't know about. So you have to promise me when the book is done that you'll come back on the show and we can talk about it again, okay? Yeah. I mean, we'll talk about the new book just like we talked about this one.
I'd love to do it.
Okay, well, that would be great. Again, Toby, thanks very much for being on the show. I really appreciated having you, and it's a good to touch base with you again.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
All right. Take care now. Bye-bye.
You too.
You've been listening to an interview with Toby Lester about his new book, The Fourth Part of the World, The Race to the Ends of the Earth, and the Epic Story of the Map That Gave America Its Name. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.